Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
This week on Truth and Movies, Claire Foy dons the dragon tattoo in Scandi thriller spin-off The Girl in the Spider's Web.
Choo choo. You're my sister.
Hirokazu Koreeda spins a tale about an unconventional Japanese family in the Cannes Prize winning Shoplifters. And in Film Club, we revisit a classic of Japanese cinema, Yasujirō Ozu's Tokyo Story. All coming up in Truth and Movies, a Little White Lies podcast. And we're back. Michael Eder here in the host's chair, sitting across from a supergroup of Little White Lies contributors. Hannah Woodhead, welcome back.
Thank you.
You've been off in the States for a few days, right?
I have, yeah.
You visited the Criterion cupboard.
I did. I went in the cupboard. It's a very strange experience because you're very conscious of the fact that you're standing where kind of Barry Jenkins and Claire Denis have stood.
Did they make a YouTube video of you rifling through?
I wish they had. No, they were just kind of like, tell what you want, which is like the worst thing to say because you immediately like start panicking. And you're like, how many is take what you want and are they going to judge my choices?
Well, we can judge your choices off mic later. And Adam Woodward.
Hi.
Welcome back, Adam. Have you been anywhere exotic?
No, I can't say I have. Actually, saying that, since the last time I was on, I was in Mumbai at a film festival.
Okay.
Which was kind of fascinating. I'm going to do a little report on that in the next issue of the magazine. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was really interesting. It's a huge international film festival, but a big focus on independent Indian cinema, so it's kind of looking beyond Bollywood. And just when I was over there, sort of Me Too has hit India recently and there was a lot of fallout from that. So it was, yeah, really fascinating time to be there.
Oh, wow. I look forward to reading that. We have a full week of new releases to get to, but first a bit of follow-up from last week's episode on Suspiria. Daniel sent us a mammoth email saying he thought that that Suspiria was brutally and unjustly maligned by the contributors last week. He pointed out Thom Yorke's soundtrack, the excellent body horror, dancing that's remarkable and impressive, and all sorts of things that we maybe missed out on. He thought it was clearly a labour of love for Mr. Guadagnino. The extra character worked out with Tilda Swinton, impressed by the casting, story and production details. But Daniel, you do still say that it's only a 3-4-4 for you, so I do wonder what constitutes a 5. This is quite a strong defence of a film, though. Adam, Hannah, did you love Suspiria more than Simran and Kelly and I did last week?
No, I thought you guys gave it a fair crack last week. I saw it with you in Venice,
yeah.
And as you know, I'm not really a fan of this movie. But I think it's interesting, like the body horror stuff from a kind of practical effects point of view, I think it's executed fairly well. But by that point, you're not really interested in that aspect of the film. Like once you kind of know you're not really watching a horror movie, that kind of ending where the body horror kicks in feels a little bit unearned and rushed. And I thought the guys last week picked out on the dance scenes as being quite...
No, Simran was a bit more positive than Kelly and I were. Hannah, did you like Suspiria?
I did not. I saw it with David Jenkins and we were like both very much like, why?
Okay.
But I did like Thom Yorke's score.
Yes.
I think maybe not as part of the film, but as a soundtrack, I really liked it.
Yeah, so Daniel sought me out on Twitter to take exception with the score point. I admit it was quite rushed. I don't think it worked in context.
He's no Johnny Greenwood.
Precisely. I mean, You Are Never Really Here is still the gold standard for me this year for soundtracks, and I don't think this really came close.
No.
But thank you for the email, Daniel. If anyone else wants to let us know about what they thought about Suspiria or other films, they can do so at truthandmovies@tcolondon.com or at truthandmovies.com. On Twitter or on the comments page on lwlies.com/podcast. So let's kick off with the new releases this week. The first one is The Girl in the Spider's Web. So So leather-clad hacker vigilante Lisbeth Salander is back. She's tasked with stealing a top-secret government computer program and soon gets caught in a web of intrigue involving nuclear access codes, Russian thugs, and her evil twin sister. The role of Lisbeth was in the past assumed by Noomi Rapace and Rooney Mara, but this soft reboot stars Claire Foy. Here she is, showing off her Swedish accent.
I've imagined this moment for so long. I had a whole speech prepared.
I don't care, just shoot me.
Shoot you? You're my sister. Someone always has to carry the pain, Libby. Now it's your turn.
So Noomi, Rooney, now Claire. Hannah, does Claire Foy stand up with the Lisbeths of past?
You know, I'm a huge booster for Fincher's Girl with the Dragon Tattoo. Mm-hmm. I caught some flack for this on the old Twitter sphere when I reviewed this film negatively. And yeah, I mean, I have no issue with Claire Foy. I thought she was good in Unsane, which mm-hmm. otherwise I really did not like. But I think she's woefully miscast here. I think she doesn't really seem to know what she's doing in the film, and neither did I. I think her accent's very shaky, and she lacks that kind of edge. I think Lisbeth Salander has this sort of vulnerability to her, but it's very entrenched in this like androgynous, like industrial punk sort of get-up and attitude she has. And for me, Claire Foy kind of like is just so not that. She, you know, this is the queen. Like, and it's probably, in some respects, not her fault, because she, for me, she's just so in sort of ingrained in my head as this very, like, prim and proper kind of British actress. So I think she was always going to struggle. But again, in her defence, the film itself, I think, would have been a mess no matter who was cast as Elizabeth Salander.
Really?
I think
okay.
it's so... to say it's a soft reboot, you have to really have seen... Fincher's Girl with the Dragon Tattoo okay. to understand anything that's going on in this film, to know kind of who the characters are, to understand the story. I mean, they're talking about things that happened in the second and third book
okay.
that we've obviously, like, mm-hmm. they never were filmed. So you're having to fill in a lot of blanks for yourself. And there are things that kind of you get towards the end of the film and you're like, oh, okay, right, now this makes sense, something that happened like half an hour ago. And I thought it was very... it felt like it had been made in a hurry to kind of get it out there, because Sony have been trying to make this film for a while now. And mm-hmm. yeah, I was very bored by it all, which is hard. But, you know, all the buzzwords are there. Scandi thriller, industrial punk, class bang, and none
so
of it.
So this is something, reading, you know, looking down the list at the cast list here, it's basically everybody who had a star-making role in 2016, 2017. You have Sylvia Hux from Blade Runner 2049, Vicky Creeps from Phantom Thread, class bang from The Square, Lakeith Stanfield, of course, as well.
And then Stephen Merchant, for some reason.
That rising star. That's an amazing cast, right?
That's like an all-time cast, you know. We talked about ensemble casts the other week mm-hmm. in bad movies, and this is another contender. I wrote in my review, actually, like, Lakeith and Vicky get a really raw deal here. Like, they're both such great actors, and they're given these kind of very thankless bit parts. Mm-hmm. And same with the class bang, who I absolutely loved in The Square, and mm-hmm. for some reason they've made him like a blonde Russian henchman, whereas like you look at him and you can't understand why he wasn't cast as Bonkist, which mm-hmm. I think would have been a perfect role for him.
Interesting, yeah, because this is a film where, you know, with Vicky Creeps and class bang in particular, they're actors who I'd never seen in films before. Mm. After Phantom Thread, after The Square, I'm like, I'm going to see what they do next, and this is what they do next. Is this a reason to see the film? You want to see some more class bang?
No.
Okay.
Him and Vicky, really. I mean, and Lakeith as well. Lakeith's like doing his best with this film. You know, he plays this kind of, I guess, like Edward Snowden style hacker who mm-hmm. follows the paper trail to to Sweden to try and track down Lisbeth Salander, and he kind of gets to do some stuff, I guess, but
okay.
you know, it just feels like such a huge waste. I mean, even if Claire Foy, all she does is kind of grimace for 2 hours, and it's, you know, I was very, when you've got that much talent on show, to mm-hmm. waste it kind of that monumentally is quite an achievement.
It is
me.
A shame.
Yeah.
Adam, were you caught in this web happily, gladly?
Well, I feel quite sheepish now, because I've got to say, I actually quite like this. I totally agree with a lot of the casting issues, especially with Claire Foy. I think she brings certain emotionality to the character. Mm-hmm. There's definitely a lot more acting going on in this compared to like what you saw previously with Rooney Mara? She plays it very kind of cool and icy, and you never really get to sort of scratch beneath that surface. She kind of only really exposes herself a couple of times, and here it's like you're kind of waiting for Claire Foy to sort of like, you know, meet her comeuppance basically, and that's teased throughout the film, and it's kind of to an annoying extent, I think. But I think she kind of looks the part. I think there's other issues in the cast with, like, the guy who plays Mikael Blomqvist, who was in the Borg McEnroe, played Bjorn Borg. Sverre Gudnason. He's okay, but probably a bit too young to play Mikael Blomqvist. Mm-hmm. And, yeah, Lakeith Stanfield, just totally wasted. I mean, I think you really could... He could cut out that whole subplot with his NSA agent and basically just have the same film.
Or just replace Stephen Merchant's character with the Keith. The whole Stephen Merchant thing was so distracting for me. He turns up as this kind of, again, and generic Edward Snowden figure, who recruits Lisbeth to do this sort of steal something for him, a computer program from the NSA, and it's so jarring to see him like just kind of bumbling in with this British accent and not even making an effort. He's just playing himself. And that's another whole other issue with this, is that it has very much one of my chief complaints about another film this year, The Predator, was that it relies very much on the kind of autistic savant trope, whereby there's a young child in this who is revealed to have like autistic savant powers, and it's like, you know, are we not past that stage now as a collective, as an industry, where you can wrap up a thrill by going, the child has superpowers?
I agree. The script has some issues. It's kind of quite baggy plot wise, and that is because of the amount of characters you've got kind of shoehorned in. But I think just as a sort of slick Scandi noir thriller, it works. Like, it holds together narratively. Definitely has its issues. I think Fede Alvarez, who's directed, I think the first film he did was that Evil Dead remake, reboot. He also did a film called Don't Breathe a couple of years ago. So he's a pretty solid genre director. And there's some really, really good cinematography and set pieces in this. There's one particular shot of like a car veering off a road, which I just think is like super impressive. And yeah, I think I was a little bit sceptical coming into this, but actually quite happy to spend a couple of hours in this world again. And I will say it's not a patch on the Fincher version, and I'd say maybe just about on a par with the original Swedish language version from, I think, 2009 or 10.
Yeah, coming up to 10 years ago
now. I can't see how Sony can kind of take this and actually build it into a new franchise, whether they've got kind of more films lined up with this. Be interesting to see how it does at the box office. But yeah, ultimately was happy to kind of spend another couple of hours in this film.
Let's spare one more thought for Claire Foy, this year in review for her, starting with a great auteur film, and same with Steven Soderbergh, first man, key supporting role in a big Oscar contender, you know, Venice world premiere, and now this, a potential franchise movie. It doesn't feel like any of those have really launched her to the next stage in her career.
But you can kind of see her trajectory from doing something like The Crown, which was a huge thing, her breakout role, really. Mm. And you can kind of see that she's clearly trying to challenge herself and not be pigeonholed or kind of, I mean, you imagine the amount of offers she was getting for like prestige dramas after The Crown. So fair play to her. I think she's probably the best thing in all those films you mentioned, and maybe even this, even if she is slightly miscast. I think she kind of really holds it together. I bought her just about as Lisbeth Salander and definitely was invested in her.
Still want to watch then. Hannah, let's put some scores on this in anticipation, enjoyment in retrospect for The Girl in the Spider's Web.
I have to say, it was like a 2 in anticipation. I apologise to the listeners because I feel like I have gone on about David Fincher a lot, but I really was in no hurry to see another outing of this without David Fincher involved. So yeah, like a 2, and then enjoyment, a 2. It just really, I was so kind of bored. The opening sequence is basically ripped directly from Girl with a Dragon Tattoo, and it really annoyed me, and it didn't get any better from there. And then like a 2 in retrospect. I've no desire to go back to this or to see another one.
Adam, it sounds like you're a bit more positive than Hannah.
Well, I'd say my anticipation score probably would have been a 2. However, I saw this immediately after coming out of Robin Hood.
Okay, well, there we go.
Automatically bumped my anticipation up.
This is all making sense now.
Yeah, so I'd say probably 3 for anticipation, and then I'd match that for enjoyment and in retrospect. And yeah, as I say, definitely a film with its issues. I don't know how much you can kind of fairly compare it to the Fincher version. Obviously, it is trying to hit some of the same beats, but it is a completely new team. I mean, the story they're basing this from is like not even part of the original mm-hmm. Stieg Larsson trilogy. It's mm-hmm. like written several years
posthumously,
after.
Yeah. Like so someone else, yeah.
You know, it's probably always facing a bit of an uphill struggle. Mm-hmm. But I think Feli Alvarez is a really competent director, and mm-hmm. I think he probably pulls this together.
That's good to hear. His previous films I thought were terrific. Anyway, thank you so much for the scores both. Let's move on to our next new release this week, Shoplifters. So this Palme d'Or-winning drama from Hirokazu Koreeda focuses on an unlikely family unit living on the fringes of Japanese society. The Shibata clan supplement their meagre income from their low-paying jobs and grandmother's pension with shoplifting, a pursuit that young lad Shota has developed into an art. At the start of the film, the family expands as they take in a little girl they find abandoned in the freezing cold, but it's soon revealed that there's more to this misfit household than it seems on first glance. Adam, we saw this at Cannes, where it won the top prize, the Palme d'Or.
Yeah.
Were you expecting much going into this? Hirokazu Koreeda, quite a festival favourite.
Yeah, he's actually someone whose films I've mostly seen at festivals. Mm-hmm. And I think he's a regular at Cannes. His film, Like Father, Like Son, mm-hmm. which I think is still my favourite of his, was there a few years back. And Our Little Sister was, I think, maybe at Venice. But anyway, yeah, he's someone who I always kind of look out for. He mm-hmm. just makes these really... Especially when you're at a film festival and, you know, you tend to be... in that cycle of seeing pretty austere, intense, like art house cinema, mm-hmm. his films just feel like a balm for the soul often. They're like yeah. really just beautiful and graceful and, you know, often quite sad and bittersweet as well. Mm-hmm. But he just constructs these really kind of wonderfully observed family dramas. Mm-hmm. And this is another one. Obviously, he's really interested in the idea of a family unit and actually, you know, how that's made up and kind of deconstructing that in a very kind of subtle, nuanced way. And he does that, I think, really masterfully here.
Yeah, he's developed this run of films recently. He started off as a documentary filmmaker in Japan in the 90s and then made a few films that did hit on the international, you know, on the international stage. But since Like Father, Like Son onwards, he's hit this stride mm. of gently observed, warmly observed character, family domestic dramas with a little bit of social edge to them. And that's what this is here. This develops into almost a comment on the family unit, the nuclear family in Japan. What is a family? You know, would you rather choose your family? Yeah. Is family bound by blood or by friendship?
He's in this really amazing groove now. Mm-hmm. And it's funny because it's not something where... It's not a situation where you're waiting for his films... with like massive anticipation because I think purely because you kind of know what you're going to get from them. Like mm-hmm. there are elements that are surprising in this, and that's down to the kind of narrative. Well, I guess you kind of subvert certain expectations we have of like the family unit, the family drama. But yeah, you kind of know exactly what you're getting from a Koreeda film mm-hmm. these days. And mm-hmm. that is not criticism. That is like a really wonderful thing, I think, because here's someone who is just like working at the absolute peak of his craft. You're just totally comfortable in the fact that this guy is just a complete master storyteller.
I think he's comfortably and quite quietly one of the most consistent filmmakers working
Absolutely,
today. And he
yeah.
puts out a film a year. He's already got another film that's almost in the can, his first English language production. Can't wait to see that.
That'll be at next can, I would assume.
I'm yeah. assuming. Hannah, did you have much relationship with him before
No,
this?
You know, it's funny. I feel like I've been waiting to watch this film for about half a year, which I guess I have because I wasn't at Cannes and everyone at Cannes had told me how great it was. And Koreeda is one of those directors who... I wasn't really familiar with before I started at Little White Lies, actually. Mm-hmm. And you obviously always speak very highly of him, yeah. and David always speaks very highly of him. I remember he gave me a box set of the Family Values
okay.
films, yeah. mm-hmm. and I'm much to my shame still to watch it. But I was so excited to watch this, and I'm a bit sad that I had to do it on kind of a screener in my house, because I feel
right.
like I would have liked to have seen this at the cinema. It's so immersive mm-hmm. and delicate, and there's a lot you kind of miss out on just because you're sat at home mm. fidgeting rather than being in a dark room, which is I think the best place to see this film. But no, it was just so lovely. Mm-hmm. It was really, you know, bittersweet and tender and refreshing, I think, to see a film set in Japan that feels kind of, I guess, a preconception I have is that everything always feels a bit sort of, there's a lot of austereness mm-hmm. to a lot of Japanese films, but this is so kind of, everything feels so warm about mm. it, and particularly the younger cast in this film is so kind of remarkable. Like what Koreeda gets out of these two sort of central child performers mm. in this is like outstanding. And yeah, I was really glad to finally get to see it. I think mm. it's a really beautiful film. It's I can't stress that enough, that if you're not familiar with Corriedo, that I feel like this yeah. would be, for me, it was a perfect introduction.
And you'll like crack open that box set next, right?
Yeah, of course, yeah.
I think that central relationship of the two kids, so mm-hmm. the film is set up as you're kind of spending time with this family unit, mm-hmm. and then they adopt, basically, a young girl that they find out on the street. And
informally adopt, they just
yeah,
grab
they
her
just
and
sort
and
of get her.
Yeah.
But the family are living in a sort of basement house,
the one room house, yeah. that's squished
they're
in between
all squished in
the
together,
elements,
and yeah. and so they just welcome her in, and it sort of it hinted that her parents are either abusive or basically just abandoned her, and yeah, there's an interesting conflict between this adorable young girl and the young boy who isn't quite accepting of her initially. And yeah, I just think that's really wonderful how Corriedo gets them to play off each other. And
yeah.
she soon picks up. So the kind of patriarch figure, as the title suggests, he kind of encourages the kids to come out with him on his little shoplifting excursions. Mm-hmm. And it's so lovely to see her kind of following suit and
yeah,
learning the tricks of the trade.
Baseball hand gestures, don't they, when they're doing their shoplifting errands.
I think that opening sequence is one of the best all year when they're at the supermarket.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
There's that great shot where the father is like lurking around the corner like doing the hand signals, and I was like, that was when I was like, okay, this is just great. Like mm-hmm. I'm 2 seconds in and I love this already. It feels like Corriedo doing Dickens. Like it's right. very, like, you know, kind of Oliver Twist mm-hmm. and sort of David Copperfield. But I don't say that in a kind of negative way at all. I think it's a really, as well as a study of a family, it's like a character study. You
yeah.
know, you get a sense for who all these people are and kind of how they relate to each other. And yeah, I thought it was really, you know, refreshing to see that. A group of shoplifters who may not, maybe it's a British thing, we're not that sympathetic towards the plight of the shoplifter, but, you know, positioning it and seeing kind of how they forged this life kind of out of nothing. You know, they're mm-hmm. surviving on the grandmother's pension. Like, that's their chief income. And there's so much love and so much positivity in their household. They all care for each other so much. Mm-hmm. And they have fun. Like, there's this great scene where it's the sex scene where the kids mm-hmm. walk in.
Yeah.
And they're like, they have to quick, put the clothes on.
Well,
clothes.
That's the thing. It seems that he takes this grab bag of family experiences, mm-hmm. and but shows it in this unlikely, unconventional setting. Ooh. So that is, well, they are the mother and father figure when the kids are out, they you know, they get it
they
on.
They have a life, you know, yeah. and that's so refreshing to see, is a family where you know, the mum and the dad aren't just the mum and the dad, they're real people. Mm-hmm. And
but then this seems like we're talking about a film that is mainly plotless. I mean, it is full
yeah.
of moments, and it's what I love about Corriedo's films is they're so organic. They seem to just be like life unfolding before your eyes. This film does have a sort of compelling structure. As you go on, you learn more about this family. Not to get into necessary spoiler territories or talk too much about the back half of the film, but you do realise who these people are in this context and how they've come together. And that's where it starts to develop this almost steamroller feel behind it against this rigid Japanese or international structure of what family means,
yeah.
or what it means about being part of the system. And
yeah, that's where it takes on more of a kind of social commentary edge as well, because ultimately these are people living on the fringes of or the margins of Japanese society, and mm-hmm. their shoplifting exploits are tolerated to an extent by the local community, mm-hmm. which is a nice little detail, I think, that they're not criminals, but essentially in the eyes of the people in their neighbourhood. You know, they're just getting by, and crucially, they never actually take more than they need to. Mm-hmm. So, you know, is that case of like taking a loaf of bread to feed the family sort of thing?
Well, they have the motto, which is, if it's in a shop, no one owns it yet because no one's bought it, so it's fair game as long as the shop doesn't go out of business, which is almost like an Italian neorealist
right.
view of shoplifting, isn't it? But Hannah, you mentioned the kids. He's such a good director of kids. All of his films, from I Wish, Like Father, Like Son, etc., Nobody Knows, he's made so many films with kids at the centre. But he also has a great roster of actors that pop up in nearly all his films. So in this one, he has Kieran Kiki, who plays the grandmother in this, and she's in 7 of his movies, and she passed away this year. One of these fantastic figures, which has got such a striking look, and plays these old ladies with a little spark, a little edge to them. And in this one, it's probably the edgiest role she's played.
Yeah, I mean, the last thing I saw her in was a film called Sweet Bean.
Right.
By another Japanese director called Nomi Kawase. And I'm not a huge fan of Nomi Kawase generally, but that film is yeah, as the title suggests, it is very sweethearted. Mm-hmm. And there's a scene in that where it's probably like a 10-15 minute virtually unbroken shot of her just making these little kind of sweet bean dumplings, and it's absolute magic.
Mm-hmm. She's terrific. I also like Lily Frankie, who plays the father figure, who's such a good, sort of golden-hearted, shifty, deadbeat guy, middle-aged
cool
guy.
Dad, isn't he
spends
he's
most
cool
of the dad. Spends most of the film limping along after his son, trying to get him to call him daddy. It's incredible. I love this film, but Adam, tell me your scores.
Well, yeah, I've got to be a 4 in anticipation, just based on his previous work, and probably a 4 for enjoyment. I'm tempted to bump this up to a 5 for, in retrospect. I think it's funny, winning the Palme d'Or, obviously we were kind of seeing a lot of films over that couple of week period, and it was definitely one that I enjoyed at the time, but was a little bit surprised it won the top prize, just because of the strength of the competition, and it felt like... nice guys don't always win in these in these kinds of festivals, so it was a real kind of treat and surprise to see that win. And it is a film that's definitely stuck with me. So,
Hannah,
I guess a 4 in anticipation. Again, I'd heard so much about this from everyone at Cannes, and I was excited to watch it. And then, a 4's across the board for me. It's funny, I was thinking about this the other day, that I was on the podcast when we did The Square, which was the previous Palme d'Or winner. And this couldn't be sort of more different. And that felt like a very nasty film in a lot of ways. And this is just so warm. And you get this real... sense of closeness from it, like closeness to a different culture, which I think is, it's such a talent that Corrida has as a director, to be able to bring you into this world that is so different, but also not that different at all from, the one that we live in.
Terrific. That's a recommendation across the board, and from me as well. And also to Daniel, who sent in that message about Suspiria. This film has a great soundtrack, in my opinion.
It does have a great soundtrack.
Composed by Harumi Hosono of Yellow Magic Orchestra fame.
Really good posters as well for this film.
It's just great.
Just everything's great.
Across the board.
Everything's great.
Go and see Shoplifters. That seems to be the message from us today. But we'll stay in Japan for Film Club. Up next, Yasujirō Ozu's Tokyo Story.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. So start getting your best night's sleep in sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. And you can try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee, plus 15% off your first order with code BUTTERY. So head to bollandbranch.com today. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Yes, Film Club this week is Tokyo Story, originally released in 1953 in Japan. It took a few years to get onto the international stage after a screening in London in 1957 and then subsequent screenings in New York in the 60s and 70s. It developed this huge international reputation that was mainly posthumous for Ozu and is now known as one of the greats of world cinema. It's about an old couple that visit their children and grandchildren in Tokyo, but the children just don't seem to have much time for them. Quite a quiet film, but what do the listeners think, Adam?
Well, Alex Dudok DeWitt tweets in with a spoiler alert. Mm-hmm. I think it's really constitutes
60 years is fine.
He just says, "Doctors say Tomi won't last till sunrise. Cut to her husband gazing at sunrise. Most beautiful death in all cinema."
Yeah,
Lenny Berger writes in to say, "A very old film for a very strange culture, yet the family dynamics instantly relatable and moving. Please call your parents now."
And BC Wallin says, recently watched it for the first time. Very different greatest film from Citizen Kane or Rules of the Game, that's for certain.
It really is, isn't it, Adam? And I said earlier that it develops this international reputation and it's now held up as one of the greatest films of all time. Sight and Sound in there, once in a decade, poll they do critics and filmmakers. This film came third in the critics poll in 2012, voted for by people including our own David Jenkins. But for the director's poll, it came top this time. The greatest film of all time, according to people like Paul Schrader, Mike Lee, Stephen Queen, Joanna Hogg, Richard Ayoade, Samantha Morton, and Nuri Bilger Ceylan, who we'll talk about next week, a Turkish filmmaker. So it has this incredible reputation. Is it well earned? What's it like watching it today?
This was my first Ozu. I always feel like on this show, like someone will tweet in and be like, how dare you be a film critic having never seen Ozu? But I like that I'd never seen an Ozu film before because it means I come to it having already watched so many films and I can still be surprised by something and I can still watch something and, you know, absolutely adore it and understand now the kind of the reach of this film and how it's kind of gone on to inspire so many other filmmakers.
So what did surprise you about this, Hannah?
I guess the pacing was the thing that surprised me the most because I kind of naively thought when I watched this last night, I was like, oh, well, it won't be that long. It was made in the 50s. You know, nobody made long films in the 50s. They did. People did make long films in the 50s. And doing my kind of reading about it, this was something that Ozu was kind of known for, his very languid pace. But I think this film needs it. It's so kind of a slice of life. You know, you really get this sense for the family dynamics, much like in Shoplifters. I think, right. I was saying to you guys, I think this is a lovely film to do alongside Shoplifters because you get the kind of contemporary Japanese family and this very old-school Japanese family. But also the thing that I think is interesting is the perception in Japanese culture of like the parents being very like important and like you must respect your elders. And in this film, they're kind of all just like, oh God, our parents are coming. We love them very much, but we have no time to spend with them. And they're all kind of trying to like shirk the responsibility. In the end, it falls to the widow of the middle son to kind of look after them. And she's just like such a doll. Like to the amount of, you know, she's absolutely spends all this time with them, getting to know them, and it all builds to this sort of the ending is one of the kind of most remarkable and beautiful and sad things that I've seen in kind of recent memory. It's, you know, it's, I was very, very happy to visit this film.
Yeah, the final shot is a real doozy. I mean, all his films kind of end in a similar way, but that just moment of quiet reflection and contemplation, it just sort of really crystallizes everything that he's been sort of gradually planting and building up over the couple of hours you've been sat watching this family. And yeah, I know what you mean about Ozu being, I mean, he's this like canonical master filmmaker. You know, you hear his name up there with like Hitchcock and Bergman and all these other great filmmakers. And I got to say, it was a film I first watched quite a few years ago when, back in the days when I used to get like Love Film through the post. Right. And I remember it being on my like watch list for a long time. And for some reason was like, maybe they only had like two copies of it or something because it took like months for it to come through. And just remember really kind of falling in love with it and wanted to go and check out a few more of his films. But it is one of those films where you sort of see the breadcrumb trail from this through to something like, I don't know, Roma today or, I mean, the film we've talked about today, Shoplifters. Shoplifters. Not just in the way he constructs the narrative, but in the way he frames the characters, there's all this stuff if you kind of read about the making of the film, the history of it, the way they, him and the cinematographer basically like constructed these sets to have actual ceilings so that when they were shooting from these low angles, you would kind of get a sense of the space and how the characters kind of fit into it. And it's something I'm not sure many people were really doing before.
Not at all, no. There's an amazing photograph that always does the rounds of the actual cameraman kind of in a sort of dugout hole.
Like in a trench.
To get these low-angled shots that feel like you're almost just sitting in the room with them. Watching this film now, maybe narratively, it's so quiet and unassuming and delivers a punch. But for me, it's just that formal inventiveness or lack of convention. Even though this is 1953, if you look at American cinema, the way of making good movies had been formalised. But you look at this and he's doing everything wrong in some ways. You know, this idea of the 100-degree line of cutting when you do dialogue. You have an establishing shot and characters are always looking at each other. He'll dance around a room. So characters are looking one way but talking to somebody else off camera in another direction. And it's so interesting. It jolts you out of your your complacency when watching films, but also it just means that you have this sense of space. And the low-angled shots mean to put you on the level with the crouching, the kneeling of Japanese domestic life, which means that there can be this amazing disruption where halfway through the film you have a house that has a chair in it. Yeah. And it speaks to how he's very subtly introducing all of these Americanisms that are infecting Japanese culture in this sort of post-war years, the occupation years. He'll have a production design and mise-en-scene packed with American products in the background, American words and slogans and so on. That's his subtle way of saying that this is a way of life that's in danger.
I think that formal inventiveness is part of the reason why it's so timeless, right? Mm-hmm. Because it doesn't feel dated or kind of rooted to a specific era, even though it is this comment on, like, you know, the generational divide in post-war Japan and, you know, these younger, I guess they're part of this baby boom generation of going out to work and rebuilding the society, and then you have this older generation who essentially been forgotten about. It's a really kind of stark, poignant comment on that, but as I say, the formal inventiveness of it makes it quite timeless.
Yeah. I think what B.C. Wallen said about it being very different from sort of Citizen Kane and Rules of the Game is really a very salient point as well. We've talked about the formal inventiveness, but also the kind of narrative inventiveness, like all the kind of big moments in this film you don't actually see happen. You know, the train journeys, which are kind of this big, you know, looming thing. We don't see them. We don't see when Tomi first gets ill. We only really see the sort of aftermath, which I think is really interesting. And it means that there's a lot less kind of big dramatic acting moments going on like in Citizen Kane. It's very, you know, it feels like a kind of reaction to all the American cinema and a step back from that, which I can't believe it's taking me this long. I feel embarrassed it's taking me this long.
There's another box set out there for you, Hannah. Take a few weeks off. But yeah, talking about this influence and inspiration, I find the connection with Kureda not necessarily superficial. Of course, they're playing in the similar world of these social, domestic, relationship character dramas, family dramas. But I find that Kureda is much more free and organic in the way he films. Ozu is very deliberate, very you know, contained and composed. Although, actually, Shoplifters does have quite a striking exchange halfway through the film where the mother figure of the family is talking to a colleague, and it does an Ozu direct address 1-2 shot, which maybe watching them both side by side, maybe I'm drawing too much of a link there, but it was interesting.
Yeah.
But there's something that I know I've talked on in the past about Studio Ghibli, the animation studio. Something that Ozu introduced into his films were these ideas of what a critic coined the term pillow shots. Mm. These shots that aren't really establishing shots, aren't master shots, but they're shots of life going on. Beautiful tableau that maybe last 4 or 5 seconds that just give a sense of time, place, mood.
Yeah.
And that's all across Studio Ghibli. A train going past on a longer horizon, railway tracks, rooftops, landscapes, etc. It's something that I think you see in those films as well. Next time you watch Spirited Away.
And those images, I mean, a boat leaving a harbour, you know, those images take on so much more meaning when they're imbued with meaning throughout this kind of narrative sweep. And yeah, I think he's really, it's something that so many people have emulated and copied since. Studio Ghibli. Kureda doesn't do it quite so much. I see what you mean about people have described him as like the heir to Ozu, and he doesn't do that in the same kind of way.
No.
But so many people do. I mean, it's something which has influenced, like, and will continue to influence filmmakers, I think, in every generation.
Another shot from Shoplifters that just came to mind is the fireworks display that you can't see. They're staring up at the sky in between these houses, and it's this shot that just packs so much meaning into a single image. I wonder if that... No, I don't know. I wonder if Kureda has ever spoken about his influence from Ozu. We'd have to look into that. Anyway, I think the conclusion of this podcast is Japanese cinema is pretty good.
It's pretty great.
You should go and watch some films. When I was first watching these films, Ozu's films were pretty hard to get hold of. There were only a handful released via Tartan. But actually, the BFI have recently done a whole restoration project. They're all available on disc. They're all available on BFI Player and Amazon Prime.
I watched it on BFI Player. So highly recommend.
Take some time and have your mind blown by some Japanese drama. Anyway, that wraps it up for this week. What's on the docket for next week? We have Creed 2, boxing sequel. We have Nuri Bilge Ceylan's The Wild Pear Tree, another Cannes film from earlier this year. And then for Film Club, Michael Mann's Ali.
Float like a butterfly, sting like a bee. Ah! Rumble, young man, rumble. Y'all want to lose y'all money? Then you bet it on Sonny. He know I'm great. He will fall in eight. Come on, you big ugly bear. I'll whoop you right now.
Two ten and a half. The challenger, Cassius Clay, 210.5 pounds.
Man, you sure that's right? Oh, ugly bear,
Come on, let's go. You got all these folks fooled. I ain't scared of you. I ain't scared of you.
218. Sonny Liston, the champion of the world. 218 pounds.
Pounds of what?
Pounds of ugly. That man's so ugly, when he sweat, the sweat run backwards off his forehead just to stay away from his face.
If you want to let us know what you think about that, you can do so at Truth and Movies on Twitter, truthandmovies@tcolondon.com via email, or on the comments page at lwlies.com/podcast. Well, Adam, thank you so much for joining me, and Hannah as well. Thank you.
Thank you for having me.
I've been Michael Leader, and as always, this is a 7 Digital production.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.